This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina, and I'm actually your only host today because Matt has his out of office on. Today, we've got an amazing episode. I'm really excited for this one. And I should say Matt was actually with me for the interview. We had Andrew List, Director of Economics and Data Analytics from Greater Vancouver Realtors in studio. This was a couple weeks ago, and this is a fantastic episode. Anyone that's heard Andrew on our show before knows he always comes armed with the most up-to-date stats, so many insights, so many takeaways always come out of these conversations with Andrew. And he's always got a unique take on the market. So stay tuned for that. This is a fantastic conversation. But before we get to our conversation with Andrew, we have the MLA Newswire Weekly headline. This week, the headline reads, "Accumulation of summer inventory leading to a fall with ample choice for buyers." So the context here is we're in the middle of summer. It's August 8th today. It's been a quiet real estate market in general, but specifically with presale, we're seeing buyers with more power right now in the market as inventory is increasing. And essentially what's happening is actively selling presale projects are experiencing lackluster sales and increased competition for a very small pool of buyers. And this, of course, is leading to lots of selection for purchasers, but you're also seeing more incentives. You're seeing developers negotiate on price. And this is all set against the backdrop of the Bank of Canada cutting rates by 0.25% on July 24th for the second time this year, and buyers unlocking more buying power with the ability to qualify for more money, essentially. So here's the thing. What does this all mean and how does this actually affect you as a purchaser? Well, rates have basically topped out for now. Prices are bouncing along the bottom. Home sellers and developers are offering deals that are more flexible than ever. And all of this means that you have the advantage to take your time, have a lot more selection, get more incentives, and actually negotiate on price, which anyone who's been operating in this market long enough knows this is a moment in presale. And as the Oracle of Omaha would say, be greedy while others are fearful. So like the Oracle of Omaha would say, be greedy while others are fearful. There's some really great opportunities out there if you are an investor or a home buyer looking at the presale market, and at least just go see what's out there and what opportunities exist. I think you're going to be surprised, especially if you've been operating in this market for a while. So without further ado, we've got a very long episode with Andrew List that is full of incredible takeaways. So let's cut to our conversation with Andrew List, Director of Economics and Data Analytics, Greater Vancouver Realtors. This podcast is sponsored by Marcon, a local family-owned and managed real estate development and construction company that's been around for nearly four decades. Marcon is not only committed to high-quality construction, but it also is making a positive impact in the communities in which it builds, all across the Lower Mainland.
We want to highlight two incredible Marcon projects. Elmwood, a 38-story tower located at Burquitlam's most important intersection, Como Lake Avenue and Clark Road. This landmark tower will feature 335 condominiums, over 37,000 square feet of office and retail space, and almost 20,000 square feet of amenity space. Elmwood has been incredibly popular with 80% sold currently, but they still have a great selection of junior one-bedroom all the way to three-bedroom homes remaining. Check out marcon.ca/elmwood for more.
And Matt, we are also excited about Soane House, Marcon's newest community in West Coquitlam, with 165 homes ranging from junior one-beds to three-beds. Soane House offers the perfect West Coast aesthetic with a more nuanced Nordic-inspired design. Register today at marcon.ca/sohnhaus. That's S-O-E-N-H-A-U-S. Or you can learn more at marcon.ca or follow them at Instagram at Marcon Homes.
Marcon, building for life.
Okay, so we're here with Andrew Liss. He is the Director of Economics and Data Analytics at Greater Vancouver Realtors and past guest fan favorite. Welcome back, Andrew Liss.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for making the trek down.
Yeah, no problem. It's always a pleasure.
Can you maybe start by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure, yeah. So as you said, I'm a Director of Economics and Data Analytics at Greater Vancouver Realtors, which was formerly REBGV or Real Estate Board of Greater Vancouver. For people that don't know, we rebranded recently. So still same job, but different name. And so what I do there is I'm kind of a dual role sort of thing where I'm a sort of front end person where I'll be out speaking with folks like yourself for the news or the media, being a kind of spokesperson for the organization. But then there's also a kind of back end role that I play there of working with our data, trying to build better products and tools and analysis and stuff for our membership, which are largely realtors.
Right. Anything you're working on really right now that's really exciting? Perspective?
Yeah, I always got things in the pipeline. One of the things that we did recently for members, we launched a little microsite. So it's not great shakes. It's not the craziest thing that anybody's ever seen, you know, but it represents a step in a different direction for this organization where we're trying to be a bit more kind of like innovative in the sense that we're not going to wait for some full-fledged product to just show up on our doorstep and whatever. We're going to kind of iterate on small things and try to make things better over time. And so that platform for me is something that's very flexible where we can just pretty much put whatever we want up there as long as the tech supports it, which has been one of the big bottlenecks for us for a while. So that site is, while it's small and you know, very nascent at the moment, it's sort of the foundation of bigger things to come. And it's where I'm uploading, you know, new blog content. Got to do some new videos. I haven't done a video in a little while, but I had this lead series thing going on, but just been super busy with some backend stuff. So that's one of the bigger things I've been doing, but also working on some new analysis and things for members that should be coming out shortly.
Do you get a good feedback loop on the stuff you're doing?
A little bit, yeah. It's kind of one of those weird things where like you generally hear from the people who like it a lot and some of the people who don't like it a lot. But the thing is, I don't really hear from many who don't like it a lot. There's not like, you never get like hate mail or something, thankfully.
We just had a guy in our office yell, I like what you say as you walked up. Yeah.
That's a good example of some good, like
good feedback. Sort of thing, you know? I like what you say.
Yeah, that stuff happens and it's really, I love it. I love when I get feedback from any kind, honestly, if there is negative feedback, I like to hear it because it just helps me improve and it helps the products improve. Like I don't take it too personally. Like everybody's got an opinion and it's fine. You know, we're just trying to do the best we can for our membership and like put out good content. And if people are hating what we put out, I mean, tell me so that I can change it, right? But so far, the feedback loop has been super positive. I get like really, really great reviews on presentations and things I've done. And another thing I kind of launched this year was some commercial stuff. We didn't really do a lot of commercial before, but I did a commercial forecast along with like a presentation earlier this year. We're going to try to add, on this little microsite I built, there's a little commercial component in there where you can get some super basic commercial stats, but some downloadable data and things in there. And I'm actually working on a couple new charts for it with my data scientist so we got some new stuff coming there. And again, that's the point of that platform for that little microsite is like, we can just add things as it comes. That's not the final iteration, what you see there. That's just like a stepping stone. And we're just going to keep adding and adding until it gets better and better. So lots of things that we're grinding away on there.
Cool. I guess, Andrew, moving to the market, last time we had you on was the start of the year.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Has 2024 surprised you?
Yes and no. So the forecast that we did back in January, which I suppose we talked somewhere.
Yeah, we definitely did.
Yeah. So, you know,
I think when you were on last, there was like 8,400 listings or something like
that. Yeah. So that's kind of one of the big stories, right? The listings have really picked up. We don't forecast listings. Maybe we should, but it's a pretty tough one to forecast.
Yeah.
But that said, so on the sales side, the year started out with a bit of a bang. Like there was like 1 month there, I think it was February, if I recall correctly or something, where it was like the numbers were way higher than my model was saying. It was like, whoa, if we keep on this pace, you know, I might have to do a forecast like presentation in the summer and say like, oh God, you know, the market's just blowing our forecast out of the water. That pace did not continue. It's a bit surprising. Like this month, last month, the June data, a little bit slow on the sales side, you know, mm-hmm. From an aggregate level perspective. I think maybe there's some pockets of strength and things like that here and there. On the pricing side, things are still kind of chugging along, kind of as expected. We'd anticipated some modest price growth. That's kind of what we've seen. Things are like leveling out a bit now. There's with the big story being the inventory one, right? Like that's kind of the big shift that's happened, which the forecasting models that we have, I don't think they anticipated this level of inventory increase. Like there was definitely an increase in it, in the modeling of it, but not to this degree. So that's a new dynamic that we're kind of tracking pretty closely right now in the data. And it's definitely been one that I think has really, you know, like at an aggregate level, the market's really in a kind of balanced condition right now, you know, so it's not too tilted in favor of sellers, but not totally skewed in favor of buyers. Mm-hmm. And that's at an aggregate level. But like I said, if you go into the micro data and you start looking at record level transactions, you'll see deals where houses, some places go over ask. You know, there's still some hyper competitive spots, but it really depends on the property and the market, you know?
Yeah. And then you'll see like a building that has like 40 listings or something, right? So you see it on both sides.
That's right.
So it's interesting because just for context, for people that are listening out there that don't understand why Matt brought up 8,400 listings last time you were on the show, where are we at today? Like how much has that changed?
Yeah. So it's about 14,000, almost 15,000 listings or something on the MLS right now, which is, you know, almost doubling that number. So
I remember specifically you saying to be in truly balanced conditions, we have to be at around 15,000 listings, which at that point seemed so impossible.
That's right.
To get that there. It was yeah. like, there's just, it was like a non-starter. And here we are 6 months later at 15,000 listings. Yeah, it's kind of unbelievable.
Yeah. And that's in the face of one interest rate cut. I think there's probably going to be another one coming up here in July. I think,
yeah.
You know, I think like part of me says, I think it's going to happen because I secretly really want it to happen because I'm on a variable rate mortgage. But the other part of me is just like, well, you know, the economist in me is sort of like looking at it, it's like, look, the economy's doing okay, but some of the job numbers we've seen is getting a little bit soft, like, or not as strong as they could be. I think, you know, some of the trends down south that happening with their inflation trends and so on in their economy are starting to reflect a possibility that like the bank could probably lower like by a quarter point at least. I think they actually could lower quite a lot more than that, but there's this whole kind of political dimension to things at the moment too. There's upcoming elections and things, and they don't want to be stoking the housing market and whatever with lower rates. And so, but that's actually we can talk about that later. What happens when interest rates go down? That's a new piece I'm working
on. Well, this I was actually thinking, you know, let's talk about lags, right? Because like one of the things that we're talking about earlier was like, we were talking about the bottom being November 2022, the bottom being November 2023, and, you know, picking the bottoms, and we seem to be kind of bouncing along here. And right now it feels at least as bad as then, right? Like the inventory's up.
Yeah.
It seems like if you do a showing, you know, the listing agent calls you back 30 times. Hey, any feedback? You want to come back for a second showing? Name the time. I'll be there. You know, it's really that feel, at least in certain pockets I've been in recently.
Yeah.
So I guess
last few weeks, right?
Last few weeks, and it's summer.
Yeah.
But I guess the question is, you hear about the 18-month lag for interest rates. Are we now feeling the full impact of it? And if so, what does that look like on the other end in terms of like how long does it last before we get out of it, even if we start cutting?
Yeah, super good question. So I did a bit on, you can find it on the economics microsite, which is like a reference. If you go to our main site, you can kind of get it through a submenu. There's a piece on there that I did on the impact of interest rates when interest rates are rising. So like that piece showed that, you know, it can take 6-12 months before you kind of realize the full effect. And then depending on how severe the rate hiking cycle is, you know, the length of time it kind of takes to fully recover from that can vary, you know, 6-18 months, really depends. To a degree, you know, we've kind of passed that bottom point of the cycle where, you know, things were kind of at their worst. From a trended perspective on this, things are sort of back on the upswing. getting more towards, quote, normal levels of sorts, but sales a little bit slow still. So there's a little bit of like lagging things happening. But on the lagging side of things, what's happening now is we have this flip of the event, right? It was a rate hiking cycle. Now it's a rate cutting cycle. Mm-hmm. We've had our first cut and I'm working on this new piece. I was looking at it the other day, some of this data. I was like, oh, so, you know, well, you know, I have this piece that shows what happens when rates go up. Seems like should do a piece what happens when rates go down. And I'm looking at this data and I'm like, man, you know, there's definitely a lag effect here. Like, and it takes quite a while and it's different for sales and prices. And it obviously varies by period of time and thing that because there are different economic climates that these all happened in, these different rate cutting cycles. But it seems like 6-12 months or something from the beginning of a rate cutting cycle is where it's kind of like, that's when you start seeing the big liftoff. Somewhere around 6-12 months after the first cuts or so on, that's where, you know, things really start to pick up. The market, like you'll see it in sales and you'll start seeing prices rise. On occasion, you'll see, you know, sales pick up fairly immediately, but it hinges on how big the cuts are. And right now, these cuts are pretty small, right? Mm-hmm. And they're the quarter point here, a quarter point there. Plus, you've got the stress test and, you know, we're already in this high interest rate environment. You've got the inventory situation. For sales to really pick up under that situation, I think you need quite a bit more of a cut, probably a full percent or something like that to really boost sales. But, you know, the historical data certainly suggests that almost every time that we have a rate cutting cycle, you know, the market does recover quite a lot. Things get quite a lot stronger 6-12 months from then.
Why has inventory almost doubled in the past 6 months?
Super good question. So I'm still kind of puzzling over that. I did a piece on it recently. It's also on the microsite there. And it, like, what was happening for me, I'm walking around my neighborhood seeing all these signs go up, right? I'm like, well, this is crazy. Like, I've never seen so many listings in my neighborhood. Like, really, I just never have. My neighborhood's super, like, there's a lot of old people there who don't want to sell and whatnot, right? So they're going to just die in their homes kind of thing, right? And so it's really unusual when you actually see a for sale sign because it's usually some kind of life event or something that triggers it. And I just started seeing like 5, 6, 7, 8. And then interestingly, some of them are selling. So that's one of the other things I'll pick up on in a minute. But I wanted to figure out what the heck's going on with that. Like, is this, you know, is there some policy effect or is it, you know, people finally getting pinched with interest rates or like, what could it be? So I looked at it for like Vancouver market and I looked across at some other markets across Canada and you see kind of differing patterns in certain places. Like, so like the listings aren't necessarily rising as quickly or as rapidly everywhere. It seems to be in some major centers, particularly ones that have high prices. Is that a coincidence or, you know, a correlation? I'm not totally sure. You know, like I was trying to actually back out what could it be, pinpoint something more precisely. But it really, like, the data was just too inconsistent across places to pinpoint on one particular thing. Like, it just seemed like it was a culmination of factors. Probably some kind of interest rate exhaustion or mortgage rate exhaustion, right? Like, a lot of people coming up for renewals that are going to come up soon. Rates are still high. Maybe some people kind of getting a little bit shook about that and deciding to list. Maybe that could be the whole thing. You got this new capital gains tax thing that's coming in, right? So maybe some people were trying to time it to, you know, get ahead of that. But, you know, you got long closing times on a lot of things and stuff like that. So it's like, I don't know how many people were actually in that situation. It's a possibility, but it just didn't seem like the primary driver of it. There was the short-term rental stuff, which, like, you know, like there was this regulation that the government rolled out about, you know, basically banning short-term rentals in almost anything other than your primary residence. But not like that doesn't seem to be a particularly huge driver. I was actually just looking at some data on the Airbnbs just before I came over randomly. And actually the numbers from some site I was looking at is actually showing they've risen over month over month. So, you know, it's like the policy came into effect, I think it was last month or something. So you would expect it to bite and then you would see fewer of these things, but there's actually more. That's a whole other conversation I get into. That topic's super tricky. There's a lot of nuance to that data that's really hard to understand. And it creates the illusion that that short-term rental thing is a bigger problem than it is. Happy to talk about that later if you want. it's a tricky one. The other thing that I was looking at is like, well, you know, is it just, I think the one possibility that I think is maybe the most probable was last year, we didn't see a huge number of listings. Mm-hmm. There was like too few listings coming to market when there was supposed to be, you know, seasonal norms. We were like way under that. And I kind of feel like a lot of people waited last year and this year, they're just like, I can't wait anymore. I just got to pull the trigger. I got to do it. for whatever life reasons. You know, there might be a million life reasons. People have families, all kinds of stuff. I kind of feel like that could be the most reasonable explanation for a lot of it.
Anecdotally, I agree. I have nothing to back that up other than the fact that we talk to a lot of sellers.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be it. It's like we've been tossing this idea around. We've been waiting. And
last year didn't seem like a great time.
Yeah.
And it's like maybe we'll get better. And then it's like, well, maybe this is the new norm.
Yeah.
This is the new normal. It's just rock and roll.
And maybe we thought it was going to be better. But we, you know, like
as part of that, it could be that, you know, the interest rate cuts are, I think last year there were some expectations that the cuts would come quicker, sooner, bigger.
Exactly.
And they didn't. And I think maybe that's the thing that's really tripping people up here, or not tripping them up, but causing them to rethink their plans and perhaps sell, because it's just like, look, you know, rates are going to be this for a while. We just got to hold our nose and pay the high rate, right? Like I don't know. That's the best kind of theory I have at the moment, because like I said, there's no consistent pattern across all of these markets of like things, you know, like the short-term rental thing. Like it can't really be exactly that, because you see in some markets that don't have short-term rental regulations, you see listings rising equally rapidly as some other places. So that can't be, those two things can't be true, right? And at the same time, or like they can be, but there's perhaps other complicating factors or lurking variables there or whatever, right? So it's a tricky one. I've just kind of been watching it thinking like, geez, you know, that's a pretty steep rise in inventory. I would have expected that prices would have softened up quite a bit more than they have. Haven't really seen that yet, at least in the aggregate data. Like it's not showing significant discounts. And like, depending on where you look, you can still, like I said, find a couple properties going over ask here and there. Not that that's like a great indicator of all things, but like that's a little bit unusual in a high inventory context or whatever. So what it says to me is that there's a lot of people out there who've been waiting to buy for some time because of the rates and so on. They've been kind of on the sidelines. But I think there's a lot of people who've been shopping for a while and they've familiarized themselves with what value looks like. And when they see it, they show up in droves to go get it because they know what something should be worth, right? Like they've been looking for ages and then they finally see that one property is priced appropriately finally because there's inventory to compete with and they're showing up and they're making offers, you know? But if you're not priced well, you know, we're also seeing stuff sit on the market for a while. Like you guys are talking about showings of people, hey, was there any interest? It's like, well, you might not be
in a lot of cases in certain markets, they might be priced similar to a sale 3 months ago.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, that's not the price anymore.
Exactly. Yeah. Things move quick, especially when inventory is rising like that. When, you know, and that's the thing, like it's not necessarily a bad thing, right? Like this market is always, it feels like it's always in like hypercharge mode, right? Like it's like, we're always in some kind of like crisis mode of things, right?
It is.
And when it's not everybody's like, what's wrong? It's like, actually, no, this is what a normal real estate market looks like. Ours is just never normal.
Yeah.
We get these huge swings in demand, like it just hits really hard. And oftentimes there's low inventory, causes prices to rise like really quickly. You get the bidding war thing. You get all these theories about what's causing it. And then you get government interventions and all these things. And it feels like if none of that's happening, like we've got a problem on our hands.
Yeah, right?
But it's like really the opposite. It's like you go look at some, I don't know, market in the Midwest of the United States and like nothing happens. There's tons of inventory. You can take your time to shop. People, you know, like they show a house. Maybe somebody makes an offer if you're lucky or something.
Yeah.
That's kind of what a normal market looks like.
Well, yeah, I guess that is normal because I was going to say, I was almost thinking about it as like it's buyers right now, like the lack of urgency is in a lot of cases is so not like it's so apparent that it's like, oh, I'll wait till next week. Let me get back to you in a month.
Yeah.
And you're like, wait, what? Yeah. Like,
I love I thought you're shopping. I'm going camping tomorrow. So we'll touch base next week.
I know. It's like, oh, I can't make the open house. Oh, do you want to see a drink? Probably not. We'll give this one a miss. You're like, this isn't Vancouver real estate. It's so strange.
Yeah, that's what happens when you have like a somewhat healthier level of inventory.
Not everybody's walking around going, oh man, 15,000 listings. Yeah. Like, it's like somehow everyone either, I guess, is looking at the market, presumably, but it's like people intuit. Your attitude fits everyone else's. Somehow all at the same time.
I think there's some herd mentality, but I would disagree. I feel like real estate's a sport in this city. And I feel like sellers, part of the reason I think sellers were on the sidelines is because they were watching and waiting for a better time. And that time just took longer than expected. But I feel like the flip side is true. Like buyers now are taking their time. They're being cautious. They've been watching the listings come up and sit on their automated searches or whatever. Or they've been seeing enough now and having time to see enough that they know the good from the bad, right? And so they're, those tier ones are still moving.
Yeah.
But the balance is... So yeah, I think there is some... I think you're right. There's some intuition happening. But there's also like... I feel like this market, and I, it would be interesting to... I don't know what other Canadian markets outside of maybe Toronto, where I feel like people are paying this much attention to real estate. I hope other ones are not. Like, I think this is an unhealthy relationship with real estate that this city
has. You guys wouldn't have much of a podcast.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Calgary is becoming one of those markets where people are more and more focused on it. You got a lot of people moving there from markets like Vancouver, Toronto. Part of it's an affordability thing, but I think part of it's a lifestyle thing. I think one thing that's changing amongst the real estate consumers is that like downtown properties, I don't know, are as popular as they used to be. I'm just sort of shooting from the hip here, but it feels that way to me. I'm a person looking for more rural property, and I've noticed a significant uptick in like competition for that. And like properties that would not be priced so high, you know, 4 or 5 years ago are suddenly like really hot. And I'm like, that property just, it's not like, it's not worth that in my brain, but it is worth that. You know, somebody's asking that. Somebody's probably going to pay it. I'm not, but I have this like recency bias of a couple of years ago being like, well, no, I wasn't worth anywhere close to that before. Yeah. Now they've basically doubled the price and somebody might pay it, but like not me, thinking I'm all clever or something, but like ultimately not getting my rural property that I want. Yeah. So, you know, but I think that that kind of dynamic or that human nature thing that I just described about myself, I think we find this in like other consumers, right? Like, they're watching the inventory pile up and they're saying, well, why would I pay that? I don't want to buy at the wrong time. You know, like I don't want to buy into a falling market. Like that's one of the funny things about like real estate or almost any investments is you kind of get like when things are going up, everybody wants to pile in. When things are soft, people don't want to do anything. They're all scared. But it's like when things are soft, that's when you should actually be transacting. Because that's when you have like the best opportunity. Things are just cards are in your favor, right? But it's hard to get yourself into the mentality that like, or out of the mentality that you might overpay for something. And it's like, it's very short-term thinking and real estate's really like kind of a long game. And I don't like to even paint it as like a game. I know I use that language, but it's not really like, I think for many home buyers, they don't look at real estate like stock trading or something like that. This is just like, they're buying a house, but what they also think about in a market like Vancouver with, we get quite a bit more volatility in our prices and stuff here than other slower moving markets do. You could buy in like, I don't know, Saskatoon and just watch your price go up incrementally 1-2% per year for basically ever. Or you can buy in Vancouver, see it go up 20% in a year and then down 15% and then up 20%, you know? And it's like we get these, and that I think is what scares a lot of people. They don't want to get caught in the downswing, but it's sort of like, look, you know, this market is one that we keep adding people to. There's limited supply. It's like, and I'm not saying people should just go up betting on housing or whatever, but if you're buying for your own self and you live in this region and you want to stay in this region, like take advantage of the opportunities when they come, which is times like these where inventory is a bit more plentiful, get out there and shop, you know, and I'm not trying to like, you know, advertise.
No, you're right.
But, no, but thank you, Andrew.
No, but it, but I had this conversation with some buyers the other day. It's like right now, like usually Vancouver always feels like shopping for a winter jacket in July.
Yeah.
Like that's, and right now it's like, it's finally here. Like they have all sizes, small through X, double XL. They've got everything you want.
They've even got a discount.
Yeah. They've even got a discount. Yeah. And it's like, this is the time, like go out and get that perfect home. Right.
Yeah.
So I think it's good logic. I think just in talking about, so inventory obviously has increased quite a bit. We are in the summer months, which might be kind of skewing things because it is like, first of all, it's about 40 degrees
hot
in the studio.
Yeah.
And it's very hot outside.
Yeah.
But what about like interest rates? We have another potential cut this July. Do you think we see a rate cut this July?
Yeah. Like I said earlier, my personal desire would be to see a cut, but I do think the economic rationale is there for one right now. Whether they take it is always, you know, it's hard to say. Like they, like the bank calculates a lot of different factors in weighing that decision, right? So it's always kind of hard to say. Mm-hmm. That one argument could be that, well, they're not going to cut because they just cut. They don't want to give the impression that they're going to be cutting really quickly, and they don't want to stoke like a kind of, you know, frenzy of any sorts in any kind of market. But at the same time, it's like, you got it. Like, they also, you know, kind of answer to like the economy, right? Mm-hmm. And like, things are starting to show signs that maybe they've been restrictive for a little too long. And we, like, we had really high interest rates. So, you know, like, so like, not from a massively historical perspective, right? We've had higher ones in the 80s and stuff like that. But when asset prices and so on and debt levels are what they are today, the debt servicing costs are a lot higher mm-hmm. in a dollar amount, even when rates are 5% versus when they were 20% or something, right? So this high cost environment is really killing a lot of things. It's choking up like new supply. We're seeing projects not getting built and stuff, or developers weighing that decision a lot more cautiously than, you know, historically at a time when you need a lot more supply and, you know, things like that. But that has knock-on effects into the job market, because that means construction jobs don't start or whatever. And there's all kinds of other things that are linked to interest rates, right? It's not just that, like technology investments, whatever. Mm-hmm. At these higher interest rates, the debt levels are harder to service. And so maybe you don't do as many deals, and that translates to fewer jobs and things and growth in the economy. So, you know, they really got to weigh that. And I don't envy the decision. It's not an easy one to make, but I think at this point in time, the risk is low for a quarter point cut. I don't think it's going to stoke inflation enormously or anything.
No.
It would signal some confidence to consumers that, hey, the Bank of Canada is committed to the path of lower interest rates. A bit annoyed that, you know, they, prior to raising interest rates quite dramatically, they, you know, they were publicly saying rates are going to be low for a long time, you know, and then they jacked interest rates super quick.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, that's, you know, really bad messaging, right? And it does damage to the kind of trust between the bank and the consumers and people in the economy. And that's what I worry about now, is they're saying, hey, you know, we're on this path to lower interest rates. But if they don't follow through with that and consumers don't see it, you know, it's going to be a bit of a, you know, wolf cry situation at a certain point, right?
What, you know, just thinking back to, you know, this idea of, so interest rate cuts start, it's like between 6 to 12 months. So when things pick up, so we're talking end of 2024, spring of 2025 should be more robust than it is now. What about, like, the X factor there is probably debt levels, right? Like, is that...
Could be, yeah.
Yeah, or maybe I'll put it to you. Is that an X factor?
Do you mean like debt levels in terms of like an average, like, just person in a mortgage or something?
Or even just that Canadians have real... historically high, so high debt levels, and it's been a rough go with these rates, but is it like a deleveraging over a long period of time where, you know, it's just like getting out from under what you accrued during COVID and
right.
probably the years before?
Well, actually during COVID, there was like a really high savings rate.
People right. Yeah. Okay.
Like, I don't know if debt levels were, I'd have to check. Like, I mean, I don't know if personal debt levels increased dramatically during COVID, possibly for some subsets of the population who did.
Interesting.
Receive.
So when did all this debt accrue? It was all after?
No. Like, just his, like, we've got, like, you know, asset prices have been rising for a right. very long time, 20, 30 years.
Right.
It's just like a general level of inflation of things, right? Like, look at what a house costs in Vancouver now, right?
Yeah.
So if your mortgage rate's 5% on a $2 million mortgage, the dollar amount that you pay per month is
sure.
pretty high relative to, like, if you had a 20% interest rate, but your house was $100,000.
Right.
That kind of thing. But yeah, on the personal debt side, like, I think the data that I've seen, and I'm just trying to be, I think what I recall seeing was that, like, the, what do they call, like, unsecured debt? So credit cards, things like that, is not like dangerous levels in Canada or something, or like, well, actually, I don't think any of the debt's necessarily dangerous levels, but I think what I saw was that most of the debt that Canadians have is secured debt. So it is kind of... If there is a deleveraging or something, well, then assets get sold or whatever. Yeah. So it's not like money just disappears, essentially, like the way that it does with unsecured debt. You just never collect on that, right?
Yeah.
But that whole thing, like, a lot of that's in mortgages or things linked to, you know, home equity or something like that, or whatever it may be. And, you know, some people make big deals about those kinds of things. They look at these, like, you'll hear these, like, our debt to GDP ratio is ridiculous, blah, blah, blah. It's like, yeah, well, you know, yes, but, right? Like, that's a kind of long conversation, but it's like, there's context to that. You can sustain high debt to GDP levels if there's an output from it. Like, if you're getting something for that debt, it's not just like, it's not that the debt is just there doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
The debt was incurred in order to do something with the money generally, right? And if that something is, I don't know, public services or better programs or some kind of economic growth or something, well, then there's you're getting a return on your investment.
Mm-hmm.
If the debt's just sitting there as dumb money, like with no use, then that's obviously bad. But that's not how that debt typically gets incurred. So, you know, that's one of the things that gets weird about those debt to GDP ratios. Like you have to kind of consider the overall living standards of various countries, like how, like what services people have. We have healthcare, you know, these kinds of things. This is how countries pay for it. Like mm-hmm. they use debt and debt markets and so on. And there's taxes and that kind of that. All of this comes together into this picture of like why things look the way they do. And when you look across, you know, a lot of very developed nations, they have fairly similar debt to GDP ratios because, you know, conditions are similar in their countries, like in the things that people can buy or whatever, go out, education level, schools, whatever, right? Like mm-hmm. it's kind of part of the whole thing. So it's not just because you have a high debt to GDP ratio does not necessarily mean that your country's at risk of, you know, some economic calamity or something like that.
Right. Do you track days on market as like a meaningful?
I do and don't like to it. So that's a tricky one because days on market's like, so there, you've probably heard the, you know, accusations that realtors
cancel
juice the
relist.
Stat or whatever,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And I don't know that that's a like an accurate depiction of what's really happening with it, but that is one of the problems with the metric is that when a listing gets canceled and so on, then the days on market resets and it kind of changes, you know, like there you can actually do like a cumulative days on market, like right from the first listing of the property, but then it's, anyways, it gets tricky to analyze. And this is the issue with the days on market. It is useful in an aggregate sense. I think if you're looking at kind of higher level aggregate data, it gives you a sense of how long properties are sitting on the market in a kind of indication only kind of way. You know, I wouldn't take it too literally. Like if days on market's 30, doesn't mean it's going to take 30 days to sell your property, right?
Right.
Like don't take it too literally. But if it was 15 and now it's 30, you know, that tells you that like something's going on there,
right.
And it's a little harder to sell. So it gives you an indication that, hey, maybe you need to be a bit more aggressive on pricing, or maybe you need to find a better way of marketing or something, you know, whatever it may be. But in and of itself, like that metric can be a little tricky to use. I've thrown it in some forecasting models and stuff before, and it usually kind of messes things up. It like, because it can skew certain ways, it don't really represent the true trends when
right.
considering all of the other factors, new listings, like the sales and everything. When you put all these things together, the days on market can sometimes like act in ways that's not congruent with what the other indicators are doing. And it's sort of like, so that it can be somewhat misleading, I guess, is what I'm saying in certain contexts. And so yes, I do track it sorta, but I use it somewhat cautiously and sparingly. And I been thinking of ways to like analyze that a little bit more carefully because there is that issue of the relist thing, but it requires a little bit of like data cleaning and analysis there to like get a nice read on what the true kind of trends are underneath that,
right?
Accounting for the fact that listings cancel and so on. So that is something I actually have on my list of to-dos, but it's kind of lower down there because it's like it's a bit of a tricky one to do, and I've got a bunch of other high priority things in the way. But that is one that I would like to look at a little bit more closely.
I'm trying to think about like, because I mean, one thing you said is prices have been stickier than you would have thought with
yeah.
this amount of inventory. And I guess we've seen inventory increase, we've seen sales volume decrease. And I wonder in certain areas, like, I mean, there's always areas that transact and certain property types that transact. But I mean, I guess, are we in a period of price discovery? And are there certain metrics that you look at?
Well, even absorption or sales
absorption,
volume,
right?
Yeah.
Like, well, absorption alone should inform part of that story, right? But are there certain things, like, do you care about that or do you care?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean.
Or like, is that predictive? Like, can you be like, okay, like June was 19.1 below the 10-year average, inventories at this, that suggests something about the next 3 to 6 months?
That we're going to be finding new pricing in the market.
Yeah. So if you build a little forecast model, like a really simple one, you take like sales and you take inventory and prices and you put them in a little model, the variable that's going to drive the price side of it the most, it's going to have the most sensitivity to price side is the inventory one. Not so much the sales. Like the sales will have an effect, but the swamp out effect is really through the inventory because it's that choice that people have. When inventory is super low, prices will rise pretty quickly. When inventory is higher, they'll either decline or they'll stay kind of flat.
Mm-hmm.
We're kind of in that flat stage right now. I think to get to like price declines or, you know, price discovery in a kind of more, you know, a downward market sense of sorts, like yeah. where people haven't quite found the bottom on something, you know, I think we'd have to see listings a little bit higher than where they are right now. I think right now it's like, it's kind of a balanced market. Price discovery, if it's happening, isn't enormous. It's not like somebody's listing at 2 million and getting 1.5, you know, like, or like, I haven't seen anything like that really that I can think of. It might be listing at 2 million and getting 1.9 or 1.875 or something, which is like, is that price discovery or just, you know, how offers come in, right? Like nobody ever really offers like the offer, the asking price, really, unless you're in a kind of hot market where that's kind of necessary in order to get competitive bid. But like I said, it's not necessarily unhealthy to be in a situation where people can offer what they're willing to pay, what's comfortable for their budget and what, you know, suits their need. And if it doesn't work out, they can move on to another property. And eventually something will work out for them. But it's a dynamic that takes a little bit more time. Is that something that's going to translate to downward price pressure? Like I said, I don't know that I would go that far yet because we have the potential of more rate cuts. We've got like this maybe another quarter point, which I know isn't juicing things enormously, but it does help a little bit at the end of the day on the affordability side. And if there's more of those, that helps on the demand side. And that should keep inventory from rising too much further. But if sales kind of stay pretty soft, yeah, inventory could certainly rise a bit more. And then we might be in a place where we might actually see the broad aggregate price measures start showing some real declines, like 1-2% or something to start. And, you know, if things snowball, yeah, they can get worse. But I wouldn't bank on that latter scenario of things being kind of, you know, pretty down.
I don't want to give the impression that I was thinking more so like I feel like there's sometimes these moments in the market where, like, let's just take, for example, a building in Brentwood that has like 30 units and several of them are the same one beds.
Yeah.
And none of them are selling and they're all kind of priced around the same price point. And then finally somebody drops their price and it still doesn't sell.
Yeah.
And then someone else does. And then you see maybe like a $50,000 decline on what the previous sale was in the building. You know what I mean? And then it resets the building.
Yeah.
And now we're seeing that the last sale and then people finally fall. Sellers typically follow suit when they can see proof of that sale price, right?
Yeah.
Unless they have to sell, right? There's a reason to sell. So that's more, not suggesting like that the market is cratering or anything, but more so like, are we in this moment where a lot of stuff is just hanging around and we just haven't found out what the values are today for transactions?
What buyers are willing to pay for it.
Yeah.
There's a standoff almost right now in some markets.
The picture you've drawn there is one of like a kind of an idiosyncratic issue, right? Where there's a building that has a lot of units and it's in one place and they're all very similar. And that's like, you kind of have a different scenario than what I'm talking about at the broader market level, right? Like the broader market, we don't really see that kind of pattern. We see like prices being somewhat flat, but that's because of instances like this that you're describing in other places. But at an aggregate level, we just sort of see prices being flat. Sure, in like small pockets and stuff and certain buildings or whatever, you may definitely see prices reset, as you said. But at the same time, it kind of just hinges on the building and stuff. It's like, this is what happens when you get these scenarios where you have kind of more supply, which is what governments and all these people want.
Everybody's been calling for it.
They want it, right? But then when it shows up, they don't want it. And they're like, I don't want to buy that because look, there's 10 other units in the building. It's like, well, didn't you say you wanted a 4? Yeah. Like it's literally happening.
If it was the only one, there'd be 10 people.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but it gets, you know, that's exactly it, right? But as those units do sell, some of them come off market, right? Then the building doesn't have 30 units, it's got 10, and maybe then it has 5, and suddenly the price is like, well, people want to be in that area. They don't have a lot of choice. That's the one unit, and then suddenly you're back moving the prices up. And that's one of the weird things about condo product, particularly in large buildings, is like, you know, one comp can really set a building in some ways. And it depends, though, like on the spot and location, but yeah, that can happen. But in like the detached market and things, it's a little different. You know, a lot of properties are unique. Now with development value under the land in a lot of places, there's other considerations. And so probably won't find that kind of dynamic of like a pileup of 30 of the same houses.
Because
if you did, it would be a land assembly and it'd be gone pretty quick. Well, maybe it wouldn't be gone too quick right now, but
Hey, everyone. Pardon the interruption. We just want to take a quick minute to thank the following sponsors who make this show possible.
This podcast is sponsored by Common Ground Consulting.
Are you developing in the Lower Mainland? Common Ground Consulting is a development management and consulting company with experience in single family, townhouses, multifamily, and commercial developments.
What I love about Common Ground, Adam, is they manage the whole development process, from due diligence and feasibility reports for initial purchase of land to completing rezoning, development permits, and building permits.
They streamline the whole process with strong relationships with sub-consultants and municipalities and a deep understanding of all city requirements.
Common Ground Consulting. Feasibility and efficiency prioritized every step of the way.
Learn more at commonground-consulting.com or 604-807-6419.
We are also sponsored by Oakland Realty. This is our real estate brokerage, best brokerage in the city, hands down. If you are in the industry, a new agent, an aspiring agent, somebody just looking to make a change, new culture, new energy, new resources, head over to oakland.com/join, type in VRP 2020. That's oakland.com/join, type in VRP 2020. Not only do you get to meet Michael Morgan and the gang, the bigwigs over at Oakland, you get a huge incentive for first going to oakland.com/join, typing in VRP 2020.
And I built a straw man there.
No, but, kind it, of on but purpose, it's not.
But it does apply. Like I,
but it's
I,
not a straw man, really. I mean, because it's... There's more than one building around transit nodes right now that have completed recently where somebody bought it either speculating or as an investment where it's a really hard to carry it right now. Yeah. Like there's a lot of those listings. If you go shopping around in Lougheed or in Brentwood, you're like, wow, this is
an arguably,
there's a lot of people that want to sell right now. Whether they'll sell at the prices they're going to get, who knows? But, and maybe they pull them or maybe they, you know, they're cash flow negative in a way they don't want to be for the next year and they just, but they're not going to sell at a lower price. Who knows? But that is, I don't think you're like,
it's hard. Cause I agree. It's like, you're looking at the market as a whole.
Yeah, it's just and different
you're,
perspective.
Or, you know, for the forest and you're kind of seeing like, hey, we're seeing stuff being sticky across the board. And I'm like, well, specifically this certain types of product. Right.
Yeah.
But I do feel like condos are an interesting thing to watch. Cause I agree with you. I mean, if you buy a nice house in Vancouver on a big lot, I mean, you're always going to be, you're always going to be kind of the crown jewel, I think, of the market at that moment. But I think it's challenging if you have a cookie, not a cookie cutter product, but a common product in an area full of that product, and there's lots on the market.
Well, and also are an investor product when investors aren't shopping. Like that's another thing, right?
Well,
like,
you know, and that's the thing, right? We had pretty strong new development happen. There's, you know, record level starts the past few years, right? So a lot of projects are completing. You've got that supply that's showing up, and that's exactly what everybody's been begging for at the policy levels and things. It's showing up, and, you know, this is the impact of that. Mm-hmm. You see that in certain buildings, but like, it's a short-lived impact, I would say, right? Like, there's only so much of that. We keep piping in new people into this province and so on. So like, the growth is happening under the hood. It just takes time to digest these little pockets of kind of excess inventory, if you will. But they're like micro pockets, right? Maybe it might be a building. It might not be an area. It's just a building. And I mean, that's just typical absorption. And from, you know, from a developer perspective, I guess, you know, like a lot of the units are pre-sold. So once they've got that, it's not really, they're not too concerned really themselves about like the last few units or whatever, when people, it's like they're delivering a product to market. What happens after that is kind of like the market's responsibility to a degree. And like, this is the dynamic that people hope for with all the new supply. So like, you could argue it's a good thing, right? But you know, for the people holding those properties, I don't know that they'd be arguing it's such a good thing, right? And this is the irony of the whole supply conundrum, right? Is like, there's all these people saying, oh yeah, we need all this supply. It's like, well, who's going to finance it, right?
Yeah.
You guys want to go in on a property and sell it for less than we, you know, invested? Yeah. Like, you just don't really get a lot of takers for that kind of thing. And that's ultimately what you're proposing when you're saying flood the market with new units and stuff. It's just, you know, realistically finding investors willing to take those kinds of risks. And like, if you get a situation where you talk about a building that has 30 units or whatever listed, right? And you got developers seeing this, they're seeing that, well, new project completed, tons of stuff for sale in the building, not selling. Highly unlikely you're going to launch into a market like that and hit pre-sale targets when somebody could buy literally brand new product right now, already built. They don't have to wait for like end users anyways. So you're going to kind of reconsider that. And then the investors looking at that are going to say, well, doesn't look like a great situation right now. You know, like, why would I park my money there? And there's all this competition. It just doesn't seem like a good ROI for me. So you don't get the starts. And then you get the cycle again of like housing prices going up, not enough supply. And you just really get yourself out of it. Because the dynamic is one of investment and return on investment. If you somehow change the game of housing so it isn't that, well, yeah, then you'd get a different dynamic. But this is the dynamic that's established by rules of law, property rights, all of these things that we've commonly agreed to as humans in a society. That's how it works, basically. So, yeah.
Residential Tenancy Act has changed.
Yeah, that one's...
Can we talk? Can we talk about that?
Well, exactly on that investor side right now. So if you're going to switch the rules up, right, and make it harder to evict a tenant, which there's... arguments in favor of that, right?
Of course.
It's not... So, okay, let me back this up. For listeners who don't know, the rental market is actually comprised of two kind of separate markets, okay, in Canada and almost everywhere in the world. But I'm going to speak specifically about Canada here. And like what we have is we have a market that's called purpose-built rental. We call the primary rental market. This is the one that CMHC reports their main vacancy rate, their big rental market report that they put out every year. It primarily speaks to that segment of the market. These are like investor-owned large buildings, typically investor-owned, you know, of some sort. And these are like commercial-style real estate, right? That subset of the market only makes up about like a third of rental or so in BC. The other two-thirds of renters in BC live in what's called secondary rental market. So individual investors or people with a basement suite or something like that. Somebody might buy a condo, lease it out, that kind of thing. Two-thirds of renters live in that. It's not the other way around.
Yeah.
So when CMHC says the vacancy rate's 0.9%, they're talking about the primary rental market primarily, unless they're specifically talking about their condo market survey, which again, only talks about condo very specifically, not basement suites, not all of that stuff. We don't know what the vacancy rate is in that segment of the market because nobody surveys it. We have no idea. What we could say is it's probably low because rents continue to rise, right? So you could infer that. But we just don't know the actual number. We do know the CMHC number for that one segment of the market. We have no idea what's going on the other side of it in terms of what's available. What I do know from research that I've done is that the market's huge. There's an enormous number of those investors out there who have these things. And that's largely how our rental stock has grown in this province for many, many years. That's how most renters live in this province, is in those kinds of units that are secondary rental market. And this is where the government's stepping in with this kind of policy, because that situation where it isn't professionally managed buildings and so on creates a situation where some, not all, but some landlords might have incentives to boot out tenants, you know, in ways that it's not particularly a good thing for anybody, really, aside from the person who might own the property, and, you know, kind of abuse the rules of the game a bit, you know. And unfortunately, that kind of dynamic that's happened over time has caught the eye of government, obviously. And now they're putting in this regulation that's going to make it 2 to 4 months to evict somebody. And that's going to cause it's going to really put a big pause on the amount of investors willing to do secondary rental market. Like the investor who might buy a pre-sale condo, now they're looking at a situation where it's going to be almost impossible to get someone out of a unit should they want to sell it or something. It'll take a really long time. 4 months. Like, look what happened with inventory in 4 months. They could have listed at a point in time when things were good, but by the time you could sell it, the market's not, you know. So it's going to change that dynamic dramatically. And I'm a bit concerned that it perhaps tilts the scales a little too much in favor of tenants or something. And I'm not trying to say one should be better than the other or something like that. One should be treated more fairly than the other. Like, you need fairness at all levels. But this, I think, is a bit short-sighted in that, like, if you want more supply, you want those kinds of things, that's your big policy platform that they've wheeled out. This seems antithetical to that, in my view. But, you know, at the same time, it is important to have those kinds of like tenant protections. Like, it sucks if you're a tenant and you get evicted because some guy said, oh, well, you know, my family's moving in, and they don't move in.
Yeah.
That's horrible. And that's not fair. And like, that absolutely shouldn't happen. But I think there's other mechanisms you could impose to deal with that problem than just extending this time, right? There's different policy ways of treating that. So, yeah, it's tricky.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting to me is that usually people have rate holds for 3 months,
yeah,
which your rate hold expires in between the time you purchase and you potentially complete on a tenanted property. Like that seems like one challenge. The inventory situation, like you said, or COVID or a flood,
right,
or a fire or whatever, you're just extending this period where you're not completing on a property and all the issues that could potentially happen in between. Not to mention, if I bought a tenanted property today and we're in mid-July, I'd be moving in December.
Yeah.
Which no one I know is shopping for a house with the thought that they're going to hopefully be in by Christmas.
Yeah.
So I wonder, I guess specifically for you, and this is more of a have you thought of, presumably you have, is there a way to chart the price differentials between tenanted properties and either vacant or owner-occupied moving forward? Because it strikes me as, you know, and we don't even have to have 30 listings. If you have 2 or 3 listings in a desirable location and 1 or 2 of those are tenanted, you know, it could be the best tenant in the world, but it's significantly less attractive for almost anyone buying that property.
Yeah, that's a very real possibility. So it is possible to some degree to do that kind of analysis. It's actually something I was looking into. I think I was talking with like Kevin Skipweather or something who I think it was him who mentioned this possibility. Like, is there a price difference between these things? And I said to him, like, yeah, we could probably look at this because in the MLS data, we do have a flag in the data that's like, is the property tenanted or vacant?
Right.
The trouble is that that's not a very like reliable flag. Like it's, you know, it's not the data quality level on it is low is what I would say.
And also, you know, like I just literally was looking at a listing where it's tenanted, but the tenant's leaving at the end of the month,
yeah,
type thing. It says in the realtor remarks. So that's how do you right. catch that?
Yeah. So it's really like it's kind of tricky, but you know, with enough data, you know, probably some of those nuances wash out and maybe we can look at something. And so, yeah, that would be an interesting one to look at like over time is if we start seeing a price differential between tenanted stuff versus non-tenanted as this policy comes into effect and, you know, see if it has a chilling effect on tenanted properties like
yeah.
in terms of price or the ability to sell. We could probably even look at, you know, like back to that days on market thing, we could possibly look at, you know, is it taking a lot longer time to sell a tenanted property or whatever?
Right.
But yeah, you know, it's really kind of unfortunate because it's like a policy that means well to protect a certain subset of vulnerable individuals.
Sure.
But, you know, it can have a kind of pretty bad effect on this on the supply side of things of not like freeing up new properties. It's going to maybe cause some people to rethink if when they sell, you know, and like that kind of concerns me because like you don't really want to have, I don't think it's good when governments put policies in that kind of force a decision on somebody that cause them to delay a decision to do something like in a big way, like
right.
6 months, a year or something, right? Where they put something in and it's like, well, now because of this, maybe we'll wait till next year or something. Well, because what that does is it kind of messes up the gears of a housing
right.
market, right? You have something functioning relatively smoothly and then you just stop a gear.
Right.
And then all these other gears start, you know, getting bungled up. And that's how things like the housing market's kind of fluid. There's like people moving in and out of one space into another. If you put a big log jam in one area, you're going to have people piling up in certain places and that's going to cause problems.
Well, this is, and you know, we were talking to Wendy Waters and I'm not sure if it will have aired yet before or after, but right in and around the same time from GWL
right.
Realty. And what she was saying is in markets like in Alberta and other places in Canada, their turnover in the purpose-built rental they have is like 30-40%. In Vancouver and Toronto, it's like 10%.
Yeah.
Like people delay life decisions because of, you know, rents from 5, 7, 10 years ago, whenever it is.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking of policies that work that way. But then also, yeah, like in terms of actual selling houses, like it just seems like the whole thing's... Yeah, it's like pouring concrete into a market, right?
Yeah, definitely. It's like, yeah, throwing tar in something and just causing a bunch of stickiness in places where it's not a great... Like you really want... Well, here's what my thought on it anyways. I don't know, like some people might disagree, but I think it's good for like a rental market to have real easy like liquidity, like whether that be somebody selling their investment unit or the ability of a tenant to find a new place very mm-hmm. quickly or whatever. And I think one of the ways that you can enable tenants finding a lot more new places is encourage investment into that side of the market. But feels like time and time again, everywhere you look, there's policies that seem to discourage the kind of investment that would open up more housing. And like I was saying, a lot of the rental housing in this region is secondary rental market. It's those investor
owners. I didn't know that 2/3 of British Columbia rental stock was actually essentially mom and pop investors.
That's right. Yeah. So it's just wild because, you know, like that's the stock that can really move the needle on things. It's also one, and this is the other thing, I, you know, when I was in the government, I tried to harp on this a bit at the time. I was like, well, you know, it's the one you can kind of move the needle on a little bit quicker because purpose-built rental, if you talk to purpose-built rental developers, they'll always tell you it's like, what's so tenuous? You know, it's like the numbers are on it are always kind of shaky without like CMHC debt or something. Like you're, these are tough deals to make work, right? Like the numbers just doesn't pencil very well from a performance standpoint and so on. Like you need high rents and you need good absorption. So like lots of demands, you need low vacancy. And you know, if you have high like mortgage rates and stuff right now, if you didn't have access to cheap debt through various government programs and things that try to subsidize that, I don't know how many rental projects would get built. And I'm talking about purpose-built rental. So, you know, one way to bring on rental fairly quickly is to get people to build condo projects, which, you know, you could get lots more of these done because of the, just got to sell enough pre-sales and you'll get your construction financing and move on, right? So, I don't know. You know, I think it would be better if they had policies that incentivizes, you know, abundance instead of like scarcity sort of thing. Like where it's like, it's always like, well, we're going to tax this because we don't like it. Or we're going to put this regulation in because that's a bad thing for one subset of people while completely ignoring all of the knock-on effects of that or whatever.
And well, it's like, and we were saying like it does, or when we were talking earlier, it's like, I know there's like indirect consequences of everything, right?
Yeah.
But some of them, like for instance, I was talking to the mortgage broker who was like at 4 months, like the rate hold the whole, like it's like, that's fairly obvious, right? Like that should have been, I don't know if it's not, if it wasn't caught or just disregarded, but it seems like that's a fairly obvious, you're usually working with a national lender. This is a local rule. Like it's really gonna, it potentially creates havoc in the marketplace.
Yeah, I don't like, I think at the policy level, like they're not realtors and they're not people, you know, they don't do deals. Yeah. They don't really get the mechanics of it, a lot of them. And you know, fair enough. That's not their training. It's not what they have done with their lives or whatever, or for, as far as a vocation. But so I think it's hard to understand those nuances of things. They often, you know, in my experience working in policy shops, like there's a lot of well-meaning people who look at a problem and they introduce what they believe to be a solution. Mm-hmm. And it all seems fairly reasonable on the surface of it, right? Like it's like, well, here's a bad thing and here's a solution to it. And it's like, you know, it's usually a poorly considered solution from all of the angles. It's one that addresses the immediate kind of problem in a very sort of direct way, but completely misses the indirect things. And like the short-term rental thing would be a good example of something like that too, where it's like, look, these things aren't the worst thing in the world. They do like, it's a bit of a weird topic because like on the one hand, it's like, this is just another form of dwelling. Why is there such like a desire that these are only a 12-month lease? Like there's lots of people who need a 6-month lease or a 3-month or whatever. And to how big of a deal really is it if somebody's only renting it on nightly or whatever?
Yeah.
Why do we as a society, like not myself necessarily, but why do governments and certain governments anyways, believe that there's only one kind of rental we should have or something, right? Which is long-term rental. It can only be that. That's the only thing that we, you know, and it's like, or the spec tax. So, oh, you can only have one property essentially is kind of what that's saying. And like, you know, there's these very like restrictive ideas about what thou shalt, you know, and it's a bit, it's getting a bit like, you know, difficult for the market to operate properly. You're really like throwing sand in the gears of this thing and markets operate a lot more efficiently when you open up the market to investment and you allow a lot more people to build or whatever it may be and have more choice. And like, I don't know, you know, there's just a lot of stuff that's happening at that policy level that kind of concerns me that I've seen over the past few years, whether it be federal government or provincial government, even to some degree, the municipal levels. It's just like, there's just a lot of choices being made right now that I don't think are working in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And there's also a miscommunication amongst all those levels of government, or lack of communication, I should say, coordination. They don't seem to coordinate. Like we have overlapping policies, you know, we have like the federal, like speculation tax, or what is it called? The flipping tax. And they're going to have a, you know, it's just like, oh God, it's so like exhausting thinking about all these taxes and stuff.
I was thinking about this earlier, or Adam and I were talking about it, but you know, it's like, first off, just in terms of like well-meaning people, I've talked to more well-meaning people with basement suites that they're not renting out now and are not going to rent out.
Yeah.
Because of these, specifically, it's like one too many paper cuts almost. You know, oh, you're like, yeah, all right, I'm done this. There's the risk. The reward is not there,
yeah,
to take on the risk of having a tenant, whatever. So the new rules, it's just like, and I feel like I've talked to a bunch of people very recently that have said that. But, you know, another thing that we've talked a lot about since, like literally since 2016, I think, on this program is like the foreign buyers tax was going to really hurt the market, and it didn't seem to do it. And then the empty homes tax. And then yeah, it's like we've joked over and over about layering policy on top of policy. And finally, everybody came to, oh, we need supply, right? Because yeah, these policies aren't really achieving, they can't quell the demand, and there's just not enough supply. And in this moment, and I wonder if this is just an interest rate story layered onto these new policies, it does feel to me like, specifically with people thinking about investing in real estate, that they're like, I'm out. Like, no, I am out now. Like,
yeah,
this is the cap gains.
Yeah.
Like, it's one step too far where it's just like, this doesn't make sense to yep, me. And I wonder if we've actually reached that point where it's like, oh, you thought this would, and it's like, oh no, but 11 and 12 actually did really.
Yeah. And unfortunately, we're still in that situation where, you know, the quote affordability isn't really there.
No.
In the way that any of these governments envisioned it, I think.
And because it's going to hurt new construction,
yeah,
it's going to,
you're not really the negative impact. It's sort of like an endless conundrum with the whole thing. It's really hard to get out of. It's a problem that, like, I mean, the new supply thing, like, to a degree, you could almost argue that this latest, you know, round of policy and so on targeted towards boosting new supply, like upzoning and all this, like you could kind of argue that that's a bit of a new bogeyman that they're pointing at, right? They're saying, oh, it's NIMBYs and local governments who are the problem, right? So it was foreign buyers, it's all these people, and now it's like, it's that old, you know, your old neighbor who will not sell and won't, you know, and it's like, well, yes, sort of, you know, but like when you look under the hood of it, it's like the mechanics of it don't really work the way that a lot of people who espouse those kinds of theories think it does. Or like, this is my opinion of it anyways. And I've gone off the rails about that topic quite a few times, but it just doesn't make sense to me. I don't really think that we're going to get like some massive amount of new supply through these kinds of policies. And so we're going to just end up in another situation 10 years from now where we'll be, hopefully I'm still alive and hopefully you guys are still doing this show and you'll invite me back and we'll be talking about it. We'll say, well, was it the upzone, the NIMBYs, and was it this? And, you know, my guess is probably going to be saying, no, it wasn't really exactly that. Was it helpful to make those policies? Maybe, you know, I don't see anything wrong with that, but I just don't know that we're going to come to a point 10, 15 years from now where we'll look back on this and say, aha, that was the pivotal moment where we finally solved our housing crisis by that one policy, because that was the correct one.
Right.
I just feel like we've moved on to a new bogey person. Not to say that it's not helpful to do some of this stuff, just I don't know that it has the tremendous impact that a lot of people are hoping for,
particularly the shining bullet
governments.
Yeah.
Like, so it's a hard problem. And I don't blame people for trying. It's just like, I do think a bit of a reasonable level of, conversation around it is important. Like that we don't get ahead of ourselves and think that, oh, you know, this one thing is going to be the silver bullet or whatever. And, you know, because I think it deflates a lot of people when things don't come to pass, right? And that's, I mean, ultimately, not really my problem. That's a government's problem because they go out, roll this policy, and then they don't get elected. So, I mean, that's their problem to deal with. But it's unfortunate for the people who they're trying to help at the end of the day, right? It's kind of false messaging and giving people a bit of false hope. And I think where that's damaging is that you might sway somebody's decision to do something that might be more beneficial to themselves. I don't know, move to a cheaper market, whatever it might be. Do that earlier rather than waiting for some magical silver bullet to come along and save the day for you, you know? Although it sounds like there's a bunch of new supply in a couple of buildings, so people should maybe go check those ones out. You know, the miracle you've been hoping for is happening,
but it's only I can guarantee you, three buildings. Yeah, so. And nobody's going to turn up to look
exactly,
anyway.
Well, exactly, right?
You know, one thing I was thinking, it's actually useful that you brought it back to that, because last time you were on, we were talking about kind of where we needed to be inventory wise. And we've kind of been surprised. I think everybody's been surprised by the inventory levels. I wonder if you can remind listeners or tell listeners who didn't hear kind of the 2024 outlook,
right?
What it was and if it's changed, and I don't know if it's officially changed, but if you're kind of going, okay, we might've been off on this one, like 2023 when it was like you kept your thumb on it and it still outperformed. Are we going to have that situation this year? What's going to happen?
Good question. So the official forecast was for, I think, sales around like pretty similar to 2023. I think it was around 28,000, if I recall correctly, in the forecast, the official one. And the price increases, we were calling for price increases, very modest ones. I think it was 2 to 3% or something in the official forecast. And so far, tracking pretty good on that, but with a weird dynamic, right? So the beginning of the year, there was like a really strong month of sales. And then it kind of like fell off recently a little bit on the sales side. It's not as strong as it was, but that, those are kind of, those effects are averaging each other out. And they're sort of like in line with what the forecast ought to be basically at this point. So we're not too far off actually. This forecast that we have. I didn't put my thumb on the scale as heavily this year, because the model was spitting out what I thought were fairly reasonable values in the first place. So I didn't really have to thumb the scale too much this year. So what I will be doing like a forecast update in the summer. I think it's actually in September. I've got like a presentation online webinar thing that we do for our members. So keep an eye out. If you're a member, keep an eye out in your inbox for that. So I'll be kind of going over what's happened so far this year, how our forecast stacks up with it. But like I said, at the moment, it seems to be tracking pretty well. Don't know that I would make any major revisions to it at the moment. I still think end of the year, will like the aggregate price levels will be up year over year. I think about a couple percent, kind of what we thought. But it was growing a little bit faster in price and now it's starting to soften out. So again, it's an averaging out effect where you had a higher increase and now a bit of a lower thing. And it's at the end of the year, it's probably going to be 2-3%, something like that. So yeah, it's not wildly off the forecast, which is good and bad, because you know the forecast was a lot like last year's, and last year's wasn't one of our highest levels of sales that we've seen. So it wasn't really like a big growth year. It was sort of like a trundling along year, you know, kind of feels like we're kind of going a bit sideways on sales or something.
Yeah, is that, I guess this is like literally thinking out loud, or I thought about this when, so June was, you know, last June 2023 felt slow to me.
Yeah.
June 2024 was almost 20% below.
Yeah.
Was that below the 10-year average, or was it, it was around 20% below?
It's about both,
June,
I think, if I recall correctly.
Yeah.
It's definitely something like, we've just been hanging, sales have been hanging around like 20% below seasonal averages for quite some time. Like it's just been kind of like, the sales have not really picked up back to what the norms were,
yeah,
you know?
And is there like a historical, or an analogous moment where you can be like, oh yeah, last time this happened was X. Like, is this, I mean, not, it's definitely not common, and I guess it's below average, so it's not, normal, but.
Like it is, that's the funny thing about averages. Like you take,
Half the time it's got to be below.
Yeah, at some point, right? So there's definitely times that are sort of analogous, but you know, they're in different like interest rate regimes and different economic contexts.
Yeah, so there's no like.
They don't really match up, you know, but like I would say that, you know, I'd be careful with this one. Don't run with this one too far, but like, if I think about the, you know, financial crisis and then the significant amount of, you know, rate cuts that came subsequently to kind of prop up the economy and so on, like that was like a really big momentous thing. And it had a pretty big impact on our real estate market. And I feel like if we get quite a bit more rate cuts, like over the coming years, or I'm not sure how long it's going to take them, it won't be as quick as something like that period of time. But I feel like the magnitude of the effect could possibly be similar. Like, I feel like the market could really pick up to these levels that we saw in those boom years where we had really low interest rates and so on. It just will take a big shift in the psyche of investors, like not just investors, but like home buyers and everybody in the market, where they finally see some certainty around rates. And it's not like nosebleed levels in the mortgage rates and stuff that we just, I think a lot of people are still not used to it. Like, I'm not. And I'm, like I said, I'm on a variable and like been paying probably over 6. I don't even know. I barely look at the statement because I don't even want to know.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's like, it's over 6%, I think. And it's not a great rate. And it's like, I still haven't acclimatized to the fact that that's like reality. And then like, yeah, now that it's coming down, it's like, okay, if it's in the 4.5, somewhere around there.
Oh yeah, you're golden. You're golden.
Like, that's fine, you know, like, but it's these 6-7s kind of areas that things are really, you know, sticky for a lot of people. And I feel like just once we get out of that, it's like, just bring us down into the 5s, the 4s on mortgage rates. And I think we'll start seeing a lot more activity in the market. That's my suspicion. But I'll be watching it pretty closely in the data to see how it goes. And like I said, I'm working on this piece that's looking at what's happening historically when rates have been cut. And there, you know, there are maybe a couple analogous times in there, but I can't speak too specifically to it at the moment because I'm still in the middle of that analysis. I haven't finished it.
Yeah, it's interesting. Wendy was saying last year, I think there was what, 120,000 net people moved to Vancouver? Is that
so? We had a huge inflow. I mean,
it just seems crazy that we're below sale. I mean, I think that is an interest rate story, but we're below average for so long. You're like, at some point when the stars align, it potentially is a fairly explosive demand shock, I would guess.
Yeah. When you get a lot of people, and you know, we also have the situation of very like, they got that low vacancy rate in the primary rental market. And now with these disincentives in the secondary rental market, they may have a contraction in the availability of that product, you know, for renters. And that's going to really put the squeeze on a lot of renters. And I could see that triggering a very big rush to buy on that first time buyer, like, or maybe they may not necessarily be first timers, but people exiting the rental market and trying to get into an ownership just so they don't have to deal with the rental market anymore.
Yeah, which is...
But of course, the affordability component comes into that, right? Like a lot of people rent because they can't afford to buy. So, but, you know, we may start seeing more unconventional ownership arrangements. You know, there's these kind of co-ownership things. I don't know how big that would be. So it seems like a bit of a dangerous situation.
It's a hard thing to imagine. Yeah.
But, you know, when, you know, people are creative. That's the one thing that's wild about humanity is there's, you know, if a problem isn't solved by somebody, like people will just figure out a way. They always do.
Yeah.
And it's one of the things that like, I guess as I've gotten older, it's like, I suppose I'm more optimistic about this. As when I was younger, like I would, oh, here's some big problem. Oh, it's all over. Just give it up. You know? Now it's like, no, you know, people are like incredibly resilient and they come up with wild solutions to things. And like, we always find a way. It's just like, it's in our nature to kind of dig ourselves out of holes constantly. And like, so I wouldn't bet against people figuring out some new ways to deal with these kinds of situations. And, you know, what that looks like, I don't know. We'll find out, right? Thankfully, I'm comfortably housed and don't have to think through that. But I wouldn't put it past people to figure out a solution to a very complex problem.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll leave it there. Andrew, we do have this segment called the Five Wire, Five Quick Questions. You've participated in it before. We're hoping you can participate in it again.
Sure, yeah. Does anybody ever say no to this?
No one has ever said no, although we did have one recent guest who passed on, I think, 3 or 4 of the questions. Oh,
this podcast is brought to you by Spark, the new development sales and marketing platform. Adam, the stakes have never been higher for launching a condo project, and today's developers and brokerage teams need to leverage the best tools in order to hit their financing thresholds and to sell out their projects. Spark is an all-in-one sales and marketing software that includes a comprehensive CRM, inventory management, email marketing, and digital contracts. These tools are custom tailored to the pre-sale process to help you capture leads, increase inventory yield, and transact contracts seamlessly.
And here's the best part, Adam. Spark's team is headquartered right here in Yaletown, and they have over 10 years of experience in helping BC-based developers and brokers bring their projects to market.
So if you're selling a new development, you need to check out Spark at spark.re/VREP. That's spark.re/VREP. And remember, Matt, you can't light the pre-sale world on fire without a spark.
So a book you've read recently that you'd recommend?
So I don't read a lot of fiction. My wife tried to encourage me to read some of that because I read just like tons of technical materials and I don't know.
I remember you saying that now.
I don't read that many academic papers anymore. I used to, but I kind of weaned myself off of those. But now I read like technical documentation on how to, I don't know, how to do something crazy with computers or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know. But like, because of that, my wife was like, you should really read some fiction. You know, and I was like, oh, I don't really like, I don't love fiction. Yeah. It's just like, I would rather read a technical manual. You learn something.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's like, just try it. So she gave me a book called the Midnight Library. It's an interesting book. Like I don't know if I'm swayed that I would start picking up fiction from it, but it was an interesting book. And it's like the general gist of it is there's this woman who's kind of disillusioned with her life. It's kind of hard to explain, but like, I think she kind of dies somehow and basically is experiencing this like in-between state of life and death and has this opportunity to sort of live all of these parallel universe lives where she's in this thing called the Midnight Library. It's filled with all these books that have no labels on them or whatever. And each book contains a parallel universe that this person could have lived, a life they could have lived. And so the woman kind of experiences all of these, like, you know, because she had all these regrets and these things before passing away and all these things she wished she could have done, wished she could have had a better life. And it experiences all of these different lives and so on. And, you know, that has some kind of epiphany at the end, which honestly can't remember exactly what it was. But, you know, like, I don't want to give a spoiler for people who might read it anyways. And it's it was a good book. Am I swayed to read a lot of fiction? No, I think I'm going to stick to my technical manual, but it was enjoyable. It was a good read.
Hey, that's as, I'll take that as a recommendation. In the last few years, what new belief, behavior, or habit has most improved your life? And maybe we'll save last 6 months because I think that's the last time we saw you.
I don't know if I did this in the last, like, I might have done this before the last 6 months, but one of the things I started doing is drinking non-alcoholic beer. Like, so I used to have kind of a bad habit of like one or two beers here that, you know, it's not too good to drink that much.
Yeah.
And we were in Costco or something at some point. They had non-alcoholic Coronas and they had some other ones. And the
Coronas are pretty good.
Yeah, exactly.
The Coronas actually taste like a Corona.
I basically can't tell the difference between that and the other one when you put a lime in it. The minute you put a lime in it, it's like, yeah, no, that's, I mean, Coronas were always really light, right?
Yeah.
That one's an easy one to mimic. And the one that really surprised me that I would never, like never in a million years think I actually would like it is Budweiser. Like it's because a alcoholized Budweiser, that's not a drink that I would order ever. I'm just not that kind of guy. I'm not necessarily like a full-on craft beer kind of guy, but a Budweiser just isn't in my, you know, repertoire of beers. But surprisingly, their non-alcoholic one doesn't really taste like a Budweiser. I don't really know what it tastes like, but it's not bad. It's pretty good. And it's quite cheap. And it's like, you know, and it's great. And so what I've really enjoyed about it is that like I feel like I can have a fairly guilt-free beer or two, whatever, whenever, you know, I want. Actually, funny story. I was going I was doing some exercise in the mountains, mountain biking. Driving back down from the spot I usually go to, there's a lake nearby. And so it's just, you know, a zoo because it's been so hot, right? There's all these people out and tons of people going to the lake. I'm driving back down this hill and there's only one road in and one road out. So the police set up a roadblock at the bottom cleverly because obviously people go into the lake with, you know,
couple beers or whatever.
And I'm coming back from my mountain biking and I got myself a zero alcohol beer in the car. And the cop... He's like, hey, you know, so you got any beer in the car? I was like, well.
Funny you ask.
And I thought I would have a better line or something like to deliver, but I didn't. And I was just like, no, just this non-alcoholic beer. And then funny enough, the guy's like, oh, he's like, yeah, that's a good one. He's like, have you tried this one? And he starts telling me all these other beers. So I guess it's like a thing that's kind of picking up. You know, I was really surprised by the quality of some of these ones. Some of the local breweries around my area are now making, you know, these non-alcoholic versions of it. And it's surprisingly good.
You know?
I think if somebody's on the fence about it, give it a chance. It's surprisingly good and probably a lot healthier.
I was going to say, definitely a lot healthier. I feel like it's, I know a lot of people kind of switching, which is...
I still enjoy, you know, I'll still have a regular beer here and there, but now it's just not the thing I grab after, out of some kind of habit, right?
Yeah.
And it really helped to break the habit of that too. And now, you know, like just drinking more water and stuff comes a bit more naturally. So there you go.
Sounds like you're in a good spot.
Yeah, it's not too bad. It's, it all started with the drink, you know?
speaking of binging, has there been anything you've been binge watching lately or a movie recommendation?
Not really, no. And just the kind of YouTube videos, actually, like, I don't know, just random stuff on there. Like, it's kind of weird. I'll just go down a rabbit hole of YouTube, find something interesting, watch like 10 videos. But, you know, is it really binge watching when the video is 5 minutes long or something? I don't know if it qualifies necessarily as a binge, but Yeah, I don't know. I started making like YouTube videos for work, which I honestly, before that, I never, like, I didn't go on YouTube. I never even,
no.
Just for me, it was like a generationally different thing. There's I'm hearing that kids these days, they want to grow up to be like, you know, YouTube stars.
Yeah.
I was like, I didn't even know what a YouTube star was. I figured out there's some guy named Mr. Beast. He's like the YouTube star. This guy gets like crazy amounts of views and stuff. And I just, I don't understand.
He's bigger than Seinfeld.
I do not get it at all. I've watched like one or two of his videos. It's just not for me. I totally don't understand what the hell's going on there. Like, it just doesn't make sense. I don't find it entertaining. I just don't get it. Like, there's some kind of generational gap or something or whatever. But in making these videos and stuff for work that I thought would be kind of fun, mine are super corny and lo-fi. But, I'm just trying to do like interesting analysis about the market or something kind of like that and put it in a video. And it kind of opened me up to this world of YouTube. And I learned about all these people making content out there. And then through that, I just started going down this wormhole of finding interesting people doing interesting things. Not Mr. Beast, but like, you know, just other people out there who are doing things that are fascinating. And it's amazing how much content out is. It's like, it's wild to me how much time people will spend making. And they might only get 70 views on a video or something, but they put like 100 hours of production work into it. It's like wild, right? Like, what a world we live in. Incredible. Where anybody can kind of be a star. And you may have a fan out there who's just like a super fan of your thing. And fascinating. Really cool. So kind of not a full answer to your question because not really TV, but it's YouTube.
YouTube.
Yeah.
All right. Well, actually, I know if Adam was here for the Five Wire, he would probably make a comment about sitting at home after his kids go to bed and watching YouTube music live performances all night. It is actually.
Yeah.
That's I feel like what I use it for.
Yeah.
Music recommendation. I know because you've dabbled.
Oh yeah.
Well, more
than
dabbled.
Yeah, I used to kind of do music production work. Actually, funny story. I ran into a guy that I used to do that work with recently. I haven't seen him in about 10 to 15 years or something like that. So I don't know if it's a recommendation necessarily because the work that I used to do, like I used to produce like hip hop music or whatever. Like I used to produce the backing tracks for these things. And that's what we did back then. Now this guy's in a hardcore band. So like for listeners who aren't familiar with what hardcore is, like basically you have like a screamer on the microphone. Yeah. It's a very like aggressive guitar and drums and stuff. Not my style of music, but very cool that he's in this band and they're I think they're called Luella and they're a local band. I don't know exactly, I can't give you a recommendation of exactly where to find this music because he sent it to me just via text. He's like, check out this track that I did. Really cool. And he actually sent me a track that he did with one of the guys I used to work with in the music biz and it was great. It was just such a trip down, you know, memory lane to hear this guy's voice and you know, whatever, and the new stuff they're working on. But yeah, really good musicianship. If you're into hardcore, like it's actually quite good, very, very good musicianship. But for me, the screaming is off-putting. I can't do it for too long, but I can appreciate the musicianship and the effort and also the production quality of it. Super high production quality on the recordings. The drums sound incredible. Like, you know, it's just, it's really good. So now, I don't know if that's a recommendation. It's kind of depends on your thing.
Yeah. Luella, I think.
Luella, it's a local band here in Vancouver. So check them out.
Right on. And last but not least, something you have purchased lately for under $1,500 that has had a positive impact on your life.
Yeah. So actually, I alluded to earlier, I've been doing some mountain biking. One of the things I did is I have this older mountain bike. It's like from 2016. And it was just like in terrible shape. I wasn't like really riding it. Like it just... Everything was broken on it.
Yeah.
Like the brakes needed bleeding, the tires needed replacing, the bottom bracket needed replacing, like all of the like shift levers and stuff needed work. The cassette was ruined. Like literally this bike was just in tatters.
Yeah.
And so I've slowly through like Facebook Marketplace, mostly just been like messaging people, hey, like that part, I'll give you $20 for it or something, you know, whatever. And I've slowly amassed all of these parts to completely rebuild the bike with like very new components. And it's like, it rivals some of these new modern bikes that would be like, I don't know, like, you know, I don't know if you're into mountain biking, but like a new bike, like a good one's like $10,000,
$12,000
or whatever, right? So I've done this for maybe $1,000 or something like that all in and all new components, like a whole thing, top to bottom, totally new components, all from buying used and stuff. And but that's been awesome because I've got that one to ride now and it's super fun. I've just fallen back in love with mountain biking. I got out of it for a little bit,
yeah.
But yeah, no, that's really one of my sports. I really like those kinds of, I'm not a sports person. I don't really like team sports or competitive things like that, but I like things where it's like you challenge yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, sort of thing. So mountain bike is one of those ones. Don't do it as much. Golf is another one. Like I do enjoy it. Not as much as I used to, but that's another one where it's sort of like competitive against yourself.
Yeah,
you
just
always kind of try to outdo your own score. So yeah, that would be the thing that I think made a big positive impact. That not drinking.
And, yeah, you know, doing, I feel though like Andrew, that was the most Andrew Liss answer I've ever heard. Like. I built a $12,000 bike out of like random parts I found on. I'm like, man, if only I could do the same, I would be very happy. But it's a little outside my wheelhouse.
Right? And that's part of the YouTube thing, right? I'm just down the wormhole. How did you rebuild this, right? Like,
yeah.
I don't know. The cool thing about bikes is they're so freaking simple. It's not like going into a car and having to God knows how many systems that are, you know, in there and trying to figure it out. Like, this is just like, hey, you just take this tool, you turn the wrench, it comes off, and you put this other one on.
Yeah,
sweet.
I guess.
You know, you're off.
And yet it's so hard for me. I don't understand it.
You know, you gotta try some things sometimes.
Yeah. So,
no, it's been super fun though.
Right on. Well, maybe we'll leave it there. Andrew, how can people find out, I guess, specifically the stuff you're doing on the site, which is really cool. And then I guess follow you on YouTube and
yeah. So I suppose you can follow me on YouTube. I've never done that in one of those videos. Never done the
smash the subscribe.
Yeah. Never done that. But yeah, so you can check out a lot of the work my like economics group is doing specifically. If you go to the main Greater Vancouver Realtors website, there's a little tab called Market Watch. Under that is where you're going to find my economics site. I know it's a bit of a not the best access.
Yeah,
it should be a little bit more upfront. We're in the process of like redoing some websites and so on. So at some point, it's going to be a lot more obvious where it is. And on there, there's all kinds of stuff now, like things that, you know, we didn't have before. You can download some data that we offer publicly for public download. It's not micro data, but, you know, time series on the market. If you want to see what prices or sales are doing, you can grab that data and make your own chart. We also made some products there that are like chart book things, pre-made charts and stuff. There's also all the blog content, the YouTube videos. It's all there. So that's where you'll find it. If you want to get in touch with me directly, the email is alis@gvrealtors.com.
Is it? I don't know. Yeah, I was going to say.
You know what? I'm not.
We're
sure.
All getting used to it.
I hope it's .com. If it's not, try .ca. I'm pretty
.net?
Sure it's .com. So that's a bit embarrassing that I don't know. But it's because it changed recently. And so anyway, it used to be, I think the old one works. It was reb@rebgv.org.
Oh, it might get forwarded.
Yeah. So if that one doesn't work, it's rebgv.org. Send it to that one.
All right. Well, thanks so much for your time, Andrew.
No problem. Thanks for having me back.
So there you have it, folks. Our conversation with Andrew Liss, Director of Economics and Data Analytics at Greater Vancouver Realtors. Always a treat having Andrew in studio. He always comes with the best data. And there's so many takeaways from his episodes. And of course, that episode did not disappoint. He will be back in the future. We really hope to get him back and hope you enjoyed that episode. But before we cut for the day, just want to mention a couple items. One is Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. This is where all of our old episodes and archived episodes live. You can also sign up there for things like the Live Wire, which is our weekly mailer with pre-sale opportunities, our listings, and some of the best stats that you can get on the real estate market in Greater Vancouver. So feel free to sign up for that. And while you're there, also sign up for private client services because PCS is basically the best way to search for real estate listings in the Lower Mainland. You can sign up for your free account. You're going to get sold prices and realtor level information right available at your fingertips over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Just click buy with us. And last but not least, you may want to click sell with us, which will take you to a direct download of the sold plan, which is our step-by-step guide to get your home ready for market and to make sure that you get top dollar in the shortest amount of time. It is a free guide. It's evergreen. It's going to be there whether you're listing this fall or whether you're listing 3 to 5 years from now. Get it, have it on file. And again, it's an instant download directly to your inbox. And that's pretty much it. Otherwise, Matt will be back with me next week and we've got another fantastic episode. If you want to talk about the market or anything, you can try me at 778-866-4574 or adam@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com, or you can try our Kokomo line at info@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com. Well, have a great week, and we are back with another great episode next week.
2,000 Faces for Radio. Subscribe today.